The court will now call Point Board of Adjustment for Jeff Poole. Anthony Forth, Edwin T. Ross Jr. will argue for the appellant. Jenna Ryan will argue for the appellate.
Mr. Voss, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Ed Voss, and I represent the Oak Point Board of Adjustment in this case, who is appellant. This court should reverse the trial court's orders in this case and dismiss this case on the ground of mootness. Alternatively, this court should render a decision dismissing this case by granting the board's plea to the jurisdiction and finding that Mr. Hull did not file his lawsuit in a timely manner under Chapter 211 of the Texas Local Government Code. The nature of this case, I believe the court's aware, is that this is an appeal by Mr. Hull of a decision by the Board of Adjustment granting a variance to his neighbors who are locating an accessory structure, a shed that was located 4 feet within the front yard setback area. That front yard setback area is 50 feet back, and the shed was located 4 feet within that. The background facts are fairly straightforward in the sense that Mr. Bobby Pope, he and his wife are neighbors of Mr. Hull's, and they got a permit to construct this shed from the city. The permit was to build it, but however, he located it 4 feet within the front 50-foot front yard setback. And so that violated the zoning ordinance, and so the city advised Mr. Pope that he needed a variance from the Board of Adjustment to locate the shed in that area. So the notices were provided. The Board of Adjustment had a hearing on November 5th, 2018, and after listening to the evidence and the people who were presenting at that hearing, the board voted to grant the variance and allow the shed to be in that location. They added a couple of conditions. One was that the variance only applied to that shed, not to any others. And number two, the condition was that the Popes needed to provide additional screening. The next day, on November 6th, a memorandum of that decision was filed in the board's office. And then later, on December 3rd, 2018, the Board of Adjustment had another meeting, and they approved the minutes of the November 5th, 2018 meeting. While the case was on appeal here, because we had a plenary jurisdiction hearing in the County Court Law No. 2, and the plenary jurisdiction was being heard on both the city's part and the Board of Adjustment's part. The trial court granted the city's plea to the jurisdiction, denied the board's plea to the jurisdiction, and we filed an appeal from that. While the case was on appeal, the Popes have moved the shed, and they moved it outside of the 50-foot front yard setback area totally. And so as part of the brief that I filed on behalf of the board at tab one, I provided an affidavit from the city's planner, Mr. Michael Coker, and he also attached a drawing to that affidavit to show that the shed is located outside of the 50-foot front yard setback area. So that subsequent set of events triggers the mootness argument that I'm arguing in this case as the first ground for the court to reverse and dismiss this case. The relocation of the shed by the Popes has taken away the underlying justiciable issue. In the Meeker case and in the Heckman case, the Meeker case is from this court. Heckman is a Supreme Court of Texas case I discuss on pages 9 through 11 of the brief. A case becomes moot when events subsequent to filing cause the justiciable controversy to cease and the court's action on the merits won't affect the party's rights or interests. Also, mootness occurs where the court's judgment here would have no practical effect on this dispute. Mr. Hull filed this suit because he was upset with where the shed was located and upset with the board's decision allowing it to be located there. Well, now the shed is outside of the 50-foot front yard setback area. And because it's located outside that area, and there's no dispute about that, then the underlying dispute has gone away. And so that triggers the mootness doctrine that I'm arguing here. And the mootness argument says that since there's no justiciable controversy and since a judgment from this court would have no practical effect or any effect on the party's relationships, then I submit that this court should reverse the trial court's orders and dismiss the case in its entirety. And I'm mentioning both orders because there were two orders entered by the trial court. One was an order that denied the board's plea to the jurisdiction. That's at tab 3 of the brief on page 761 of the record on appeal. There was also an order right after that on the writ of certiorari at page 764 of the record on appeal, and it's at tab 4 of the brief. And that was the order on the writ of certiorari that also included language that not only talked about the certiorari matter, but also had language in there that said that the petition was filed in the proper time and is sufficiently pled. Well, that goes right to what the basis of the plea of the jurisdiction was. The plea of jurisdiction asserted that the petition was not timely filed. And so that's why we're appealing from both of those orders. So first, based on mootness, this court should reverse the trial court's orders and dismiss this case. But I'll also address the second issue, and that is that the plea of jurisdiction was filed because the case was untimely. Before I do, though, let me address a couple of things about the mootness thing. I almost forgot. One is, in response, the appellee asserted some factual matters and some legal matters. But the factual matters didn't rebut or dispute the fact that the shed is no longer in the 50-foot front yard setback. So it's undisputed, and I believe undisputable, that the shed is no longer a problem where it's located legally. There was no dispute about Mr. Coker's measurements, and the appellee didn't dispute anything about where the shed is located. So the only argument that was presented was a legal argument that said that somehow the Popes moving the shed violated the automatic stay that's present in 51014B of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, which are the stay provisions that apply to interlocutory appeals such as this, which say there should be no other proceedings in court that occur. There's nothing in that language that says that it's applicable to subsequent events by a third party. There's nothing in that language that says that when subsequent events change or render the case moot, that that somehow violates the stay. The only stay that's applicable is for court action. And so, for example, if there had been some other pleadings in the trial court or some other order from the trial court while this case was on appeal, the cases say that, well, that violates 51014B, so that shouldn't happen. There are cases that say that even this court doesn't even have to tell the trial courts not to violate 51014B. It's self-authenticating in that sense. The case that was cited by the appellee, the Geomet case, I submit is not applicable, is distinguishable, and doesn't entitle them to a different result, because that case was an anti-SLAPP appeal. And Geomet was concerned with why that case was on appeal. The Court of Appeals in that case lifted the stay that's applicable to those kinds of appeals, issued an order on a temporary injunction, and issued a contempt order, and that's what was found to be a violation of 51014B, court action. Here we don't have court action. The other matters that were presented by the appellees to object to the movement of the shed were the additional documents that were included in the appellee's appendix that I objected to that concerned documentation showing the settlement negotiations that were trying to go on between the parties. If the court will look at its docket, you'll see that this case was abated for some time so that the parties could explore those possibilities. That time period didn't result in a settlement being reached. I'm not really sure what those documents are trying to show because they're not really relevant to whether or not the shed is within the 50-foot area or outside of the 50-foot area. So I suggest not only are they a violation of Rule 408 and this court's rules regarding what should be included in the appendix, they're also not relevant. Okay. The case is moot, should be reversed and dismissed. But if we get to the plea of the jurisdiction grounds, the board asserts that the case was not filed in a timely way. Under Chapter 211, there's a judicial procedure that if someone is aggrieved and doesn't like what a Board of Adjustment does and the decision that they make, they can file suit in court. But it's very specific about how those procedures are to be followed. The first procedure is that you assert that in a writ of certiorari procedure that the board made an illegal decision. You have to file that case within 10 days after the board's decision is filed in its office. It's very specific. And in this case, that didn't happen. It wasn't filed. The lawsuit wasn't filed within 10 days after the board's decision was filed in its office. A couple of Texas Supreme Court cases address the requirement and not only say it's prudential, but the 10-day time period is jurisdictional. In the Davis case and the Tellers versus City of Socorro case, and I cite on pages 20 through 22 of the brief, talk about that. And it has to be 10 days from what? 10 days from when the board's decision is filed in the board's office. Well, when does that occur? Well, the statute doesn't say per se, and so the Tellers case, the Sanchez case, the Davis case, the East Central ISD case that I've cited, all talk about, well, there has to be a record of the decision. That decision is recorded in minutes. Therefore, it's when those minutes are approved. All right? There's also a case, Reynolds versus Hawes, and I've cited that on my brief on pages 26 through 27, that talks about if a memorandum that shows what the board's decision was is filed in the board's office, then that can work to trigger the 10-day time period. So what do we have here? In this case, the board met on November 5th, 2018. And I'm taking this section from the chart that I provided the court on page 29 of the brief of appellant. So on November 5th, 2018, the board met and made its decision. The board's memorandum of that decision was filed in its office on November 6th. On November 16th, therefore, 10 days later, that's when the petition should have been filed here. But plaintiff's original petition wasn't filed until November 21st, which is 5 days later. On December 3rd, the board met again and approved its minutes from the November 5th meeting. So 10 days after that would have been December 13th. But no amendment or anything to trigger the jurisdictional part was filed in that time frame. The amended petition that was filed in this case was on February 5th, 2019, where the board was added as a party defendant. And those are in the record. The result of those time periods is that Mr. Hull did not invoke the trial court's jurisdiction under 211.011B of the Texas Local Government Code. But the argument is, well, it was premature. And so if it was premature, it's probably okay. But the statute doesn't allow for that. The statute says it has to be filed within 10 days after the board's decision is filed in its office. The Sanchez case, on page 23 of the brief, I quoted extensively from it to talk about how, that it talks about how that is such an important jurisdictional requirement. The idea of filing ahead of time doesn't satisfy the statute because, after all, you could file it after the decision was made. But that isn't what the statute says. I mean, here the decision was made on November 5th, 2018, but that doesn't trigger the time period. The key here is the statutory language, and the language is very specific. There is no case that says that a premature filing in a case like this satisfies the statutory requirements. And we submit that this should not be the first one. And so that as a result of that lack, that late filing, the plea of the jurisdiction should have been granted in the trial court. And if the court gets to that issue here, I also submit that the plea of his jurisdiction should be granted here and that this court should reverse that those trial court orders and render a decision in the board's favor. I have little time, but I'll yield it back to the court.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Ms. Ryan?
May it please the court. My name is Jana Ryan. I represent Jeff Hull. I'd first like to talk about the appellate timeline and the importance of the Reynolds v. Haw case, because that is out of this district. It's an older case, and some procedural hurdles have to be crossed to get to that case. But nevertheless, whatever is in that case does not prevent a ruling in favor of Mr. Houle. First of all, the case says that if he files early, certainly it's not late. So in this case, Mr. Houle filed early. But also in that case, there was a failure to sue the board that caused the late filing, and the board of adjustments in this case is alleging that Mr. Houle did not sue the board. Well, on page 9 of the record, on his petition, it's captioned City of Oak Point - Board of Adjustment. I don't know why the board thinks that the board was not sued. They did not file an answer, but that's not, they weren't served possibly, but that's not jurisdictional. And they were eventually served. The board was eventually served. So
you amended your petition.
I amended the petition. And they were served, but they were sued within the time frame prior to the deadline. The board was sued in the original petition. So, and the allegations in the petition discuss things, the actions of the board, and it's captioned to the board. So I don't understand why there's a question about that. But even if there were, the Supreme Court has decided in Tellez that not suing the board and suing the city only is not jurisdictional, and can be, so that means it can be cured by an amendment. But I don't know why we're talking about that, because the page 9 of the record captions City of Oakland - Board of Adjustment. Case held, Reynolds v. Hawes held, that the minutes are not necessary for the court to view. It is the minutes of the board that are not really something that are necessary for the court to consider when determining the timeline, as long as there's a separate decision that's filed and intended to disclose the result of the board's decision. And in this case, if you consider the November 6th results memorandum, there's no evidence that it was filed. On the record C-438 is the affidavit that authenticates that document, and it just states that the results memorandum is dated on November 6th. It does not state that it was filed. There's no evidence in the record that says that document was ever filed. And in fact, in the appellant brief, the board states, takes the position that the board's decision was filed in the board's office on December 3rd, and does not take the position that the board's decision was filed in the board's office on November 6th. And a careful read of the appellant brief looks to me that it was waived. The only time he raises, I know waiver is a serious allegation, but the only time he raises the issue, for one thing, he does it. There's no evidence that it was filed, but the only time he discusses it is on page 27, and he says it, and he frames it in the way that if you appellee may be heard to argue that this memorandum was filed on November 6th, and then he discusses in kind of a defensive way, and then in the reply brief he discusses it in parenthetical phrases, or prepositional phrases. So, and the reason I mentioned waiver is because of the importance of this case and Mr. Houle's opportunity to brief, and I would request supplemental briefing if the court determines that the issue.
Every date you use, whether it's when the memorandum was dated, filed, or the minutes were approved and filed, under the statute, which it says that you have to file your petition within 10 days following that, you didn't meet it on either one of those, did you?
Yes, ma'am.
You didn't file within 10 days after the December date or after the November date.
Well, we need to construe several that we've got some recent cases that are dealing with statutory construction out of this court, the Caucat case, and out of the Texas Supreme Court, the Texas Health case, that tell us, give us really clear instructions. They have outlined the importance of statutory construction. And so we need to construe the word within and the word immediately in section 211.008F. If they say that the minutes have to be filed immediately, first of all, the minutes have to be filed and they have to be created under 211.008F, and they have to be filed under that section and then read in light of 211.0011 to determine how to construe the term decision, and also the term within in the context of the days, because if you look at the Texas Supreme Court's decision in Davis, it says it's within 10 days after the decision. But the interestingly, if you look at the decision in the Davis case, it says within 10 days of the board's decision, and then has a footnote that takes you and quotes the language. And so I wonder why the Supreme Court didn't construe that. But anyway, it's very important to construe this in terms of not only set the local government code section 211.008010 and 009 dealing with minutes and the requirement of the board to keep these and record these and file these, but also the government code dealing with the board's obligation to create minutes, section 55.021B. And the courts that have construed this timeline have construed all of these sections together. And one court even construed it in light of the Roberts Rules of Order, or the parliamentary procedure. So statutory construction is important. But the procedural hurdles to get to this Reynolds v. Haas case, first of all, is the evidentiary issue. That the standard of review is that all of Mr. Houle's pled facts are true unless they're conclusively disproved by evidence. The only evidence the board provides is that the November 6th results memorandum was dated. The affidavit at C-438 says that the results memorandum was dated November 6th. It does not state that it was filed, and there's nothing no evidence in the record that says it was filed. So that's a procedural hurdle under the standard of review and the evidence. Then there's indication that Reynolds v. Haas might need to be revisited. For one thing, it cites the Bema case out of the Texas Supreme Court, and the Texas Supreme Court has said that that it's inappropriate when you're construing the certiorari procedure for zoning ordinances and zoning laws. It's inappropriate to compare that to the Railroad Commission. And in Reynolds v. Haas, that case compares zoning certiorari procedure to the State Board of Education procedure. And so I think that's going to come into question. And I think that case needs to be revisited. In addition, the case relies on this really well-reasoned case out of the appellate court in Amarillo called Lubbock versus Bounds. Well, that case was disapproved by the Texas Supreme Court in Davis. Neither case dealt with the timeline. No, Davis did, but the Lubbock case did not deal with the timeline. But the Texas Supreme Court disapproved that case, and the Reynolds v. Haas case relied on that case heavily. So I think that this statute needs to be construed in light of all of the sections that apply, and especially in this case, it would be inappropriate to require that they file the minutes immediately, and then my client and the conclusive the evidence in the pleadings and in Mr. Houle's evidence is that he sent an email on November 7th after this results memorandum was dated and asked, when does this appellate timeline start? I understand that this decision is going to be filed in the board's office, and when is that going to happen? Has it happened? Give me a copy. And that's in the verified petition, it's in the evidence, and it's in the verified petition in the evidence also that he asked several times, and there was not a response, and he didn't want to file late. So if you construe the term immediately, that they have to file it immediately, as a defensive matter, they can't say, well, you were late. If they didn't file it immediately and they didn't file it and they didn't let him know when they were going to file it, and there was no indication of when they were going to file it. So I think I understand the term after is important, but also the other terms in the term decision is important. The term filed in the board's office, what does that mean in light of statutory? This statute's been the same since 1926. Not a word has been changed, just the numbers. So in light of the statutory construction rules, where you look at the legislative intent by the language, I don't know how the other courts that have recently looked at this did look at it in terms of filing, in terms of internet, electronic things, but I'd like the opportunity to provide supplemental briefing if the issue was not sufficiently raised and Mr. Houle is given an opportunity. But Mr. Houle did address these issues in his appellee brief and also in the record at C508 to 514. But the appellee brief cites page 29 of its appellant brief, or the reply brief, cites page 29 of the appellant brief and says that if you look at this, says it was raised there. That page just says it's dated November 6th. So most of their argument dealt with the term after and explicitly argued that the December 3rd minutes filing was the dispositive filing date, and that's what we addressed mostly. But Reynolds v. Hawes is ready to be looked at. Then on the mootness issue, our petition against the city was dismissed without prejudice. So there's a live issue that under the Texas Air Control Board case for a constitutional challenge to the validity as applied of Section 211.009A1 and Texas Section 211.010A1 and dealing with Mr. Hill's right to a hearing before the board to allege that the city had made a mistake. And the city has a policy where they deny a person's ability to challenge the city's hearing to allege that the city made a mistake, and they require that instead that the only remedy is a variance. So he was denied this hearing before the board, and then there's also an ordinance that if the city makes a mistake in issuing a building permit, that he would have been entitled to a hearing before the city council, and he timely filed that request and was denied a hearing, and the city construed the relevant law to say, no, the only avenue is a variance. And that issue, according to the Matthews v. Koontz case, can't be mooted until there's an admission that the law was violated, and it's a live issue.
But the city's not involved in this case anymore.
Well, under the Texas Air Board case out of the Texas Supreme Court, it was dismissed without prejudice. So those issues are live, and they're also alleged in the original petition.
They're not live. You might be able to file them again, but they're not live.
The procedural issues would prevent you from mooting this case, but that's a live issue that also prevents mootness because that can be raised within the context of this case as an amended petition. I did the research, and it's considered something that is considered a live claim.
Okay. Thank you very much. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Mr. Voss?
Thank you, Your Honor. Briefly, I'll address the mootness argument first, and that is counsel argued about the case still being somewhat, or there may be some issue they want to raise against the city later. The shed has been moved. It is undisputed that the shed has been moved. The shed is no longer an issue. There is no justiciable issue anymore, so that mootness takes care of this case and is something that will obviate the need to address any other issue in this case. But I'll address the other arguments briefly. There is no waiver. I focused on the law that talks about when a decision is filed in the board's office, and the cases talk about that being when the minutes are approved from that meeting. That's been the law for several years. An email from Mr. Hull to the city asking them to file suit is something that is not required to be answered. There's nothing in the statute that requires anything like that. The cases are there. You know, I grew up knowing and getting here, getting drilled in my head that, you know, you were presumed to know the law. So there is no issue with that. And as far as the remainder of the arguments, I will rely on my brief to address those. And unless the court has any questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time to the court.
Okay.
No.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you both for being here this afternoon and for your arguments and your briefs. Your case is submitted.